on the air, online, from New York City, border to border, and coast to coast, you're connected with Tom Sullivan.
Yes, you are, and thank you for coming by. Welcome to the Big Radio Show. Happy Tuesday to you, 23rd day of February, 2021. My name is Tom Sullivan. So, for those of you just tuning in, Tiger Woods was in a very, very serious automobile accident this morning. We're just getting word in the last hour in Los Angeles, Rancho Palos Verdes, lovely area, but the road he was on, it wasn't twisting. It was, you know, a beautiful wind. It wasn't straight. It was winding a little bit. It looked to me like it was just excessive speed, and he lost control, or somebody cut him off. We don't know. But one car accident and flipped the car, and they had to cut him out of the automobile with the jaws of life. His legs were pinned, and the damage to the car was severe. The problem now is about the legs, and I could do this job. I hope I don't have to, but knock on wood, but I could do this job without legs. I presume some of you could do jobs without legs. There's some of you out there that don't have legs. But if you're a golfer, you need legs. You need arms. You need a good, strong back. And he's had problems with knees and backs, back surgery and lots of things. So hopefully it is minor. But he's in surgery in Los Angeles right now. So the fact that the amount of damage that was done to the car, and they had to do the jaws of life, and they brought him to the hospital, and he's in surgery, says this is more than just scrapes and bruises. So prayers for Tiger. Twitter, you want to, update on Twitter, my Twitter feed today. You can follow me on Twitter, the address at Sullivan Radio, talking about the hearing today by the Senate on what happened on January 6th. It was sad. It really was sad to see those are the people that are in charge. And I think it was most telling about the fact that Tim Ryan, the congressman from Ohio, was talking earlier. We played some clips. And the fact that he says those are political jobs, the chief of police for the Capitol Police, the head of the Senate, sergeant of arms, House sergeant of arms, they're political jobs. So that's why the only guy there that seemed to know what he was talking about and seemed like a real leader was the chief of police of the D.C. police, the Metropolitan Police Department. That's a real police department. These other guys, they go around and they have little formalities, and I don't know what they do. So on my Twitter feed, at Sullivan Radio, Don sends me a tweet, says, sounds like Congress regulated their own security to the point where their own regulations did not work and made things worse. Sound familiar? Yeah. Cyberloafing says all chiefs of police are bureaucrats since they are appointed. They serve their masters, not the citizens. Yes. And I think that goes 10 times for the police chief of the Capitol Police. Talk about a political organization. Don, who is a former law enforcement guy, says more like a case of incompetence than conspiracy. And what else we got down here? Oh, JK, he doesn't like Trump, but we always get both sides. For months, Trump consistently claimed voter fraud, his reelection would be stolen if he lost, and Rudy and others constantly making false claims and espousing conspiracy theories. January 6th rally was just the final sparks and the fire exploded. I hear you, all the stuff about it. It's going to be stolen. It's going to be stolen. It was stolen. Yeah, but JK, I got to tell you, from what did come out of this hearing today was these groups that were there to kill and maim and draw blood were, this was planned well in advance. I don't even know if they give two hoots about who the president is. I don't know if they support Donald Trump or not. I have no idea. All I know is they wanted to attack the leaders of our government because they want they're anarchists. They want to overthrow our government. And that was a perfect opportunity for them to try it. So listen to this. This is Senator Rick Scott from Florida. And listen to the line of questioning. Rick Scott is a smart guy, started a very successful hospital chain, smart, smart man. Listen to the line of questioning from Rick Scott.
We have National Guards, National Guard up here. We've had them, I guess, since around the 6th. Can you all tell us how you made the decision to bring the National Guard here, each of you, to the extent you're involved or if you're not involved, how the decision was made? That's the National Guard presence we have here now. So not as a result of the riot, but the National Guard has put up the fencing and all that.
Okay, so that began to be developed the evening of the 6th. When we made the request, we got the National Guard in. We started looking to the future, what was going to be next. We started talking about bringing in the first section of global fencing, which basically went right around Capitol Square, which is Constitution and Independence, first to first. We got that in place. Then we started looking at what necessary National Guard resources, working with the National Guard representative. So that was developed with Capitol Police, working with, I believe Sergeant Arms at the time, in the evening, going into the 7th. That we developed that.
Okay. Were you the only one involved, or were the Sergeant at Arms involved?
I believe so. I'd have to go back and pull that information. We were working on a number of different aspects of it at the time, but I had my general counsel as well as our operations people working on the request and the coordination with the National Guard.
And what was the purpose of the original the National Guard that came and put up the fencing? What was the rationale? What was the threat assessment?
So just to make sure I understand, you're talking about the National Guard that came on the 6th?
No, the presence that stayed after.
Oh, the one that stayed after. So what was the threat assessment?
What was the threat assessment, and why was it set up that they would be here for, it seems like now months on end?
Well, again, beyond, the 8th, my departure date was the 8th, so the information I have is up until the 8th. It was based, they were putting them in place based on the mass insurrection that we had on the 6th. I wasn't aware of any additional intelligence at that point. They were just concerned about possible violent extremists regrouping and staging another attack on the Capitol.
So you haven't seen anything that would give us a threat assessment now that we have a concern that we need to have the National Guard presence? It doesn't mean there's not some, but you haven't seen anything.
No, sir. I've been not in that environment since the 8th.
Okay. Anybody else that's any of the others that are here to testify, do you have any threat assessment you've seen that there's a reason that we have the National Guard here today? Is that a no from everybody? No one has any idea why we have the National Guard here?
This is Chief Conte. Yeah, my guess is in response to all the things that have happened, but to your question specifically about specific intelligence, I have not personally seen anything that would suggest that.
And are you involved in the decision at all of why the National Guard's here?
No, sir, I am not.
And they've not shared any threat assessment with you at all with regard to why the National Guard's here?
That has not been shared with me, no.
Does that surprise you?
I can't say that I'm really surprised, quite frankly. We have talked about intelligence in terms of what we expect to see in the city. There are several law enforcement calls that take place between the Metropolitan Police Department and other federal partners. But again, the Capitol Police and that structure there is something that they're not beholden to the mayor of the District of Columbia or anything like that. So we exchanged the information that we have. But again, I just have not seen anything specifically from them that suggest the fence still being the way that it is now. And I should add also, sir, that, I mean, obviously I think that there needs to be a reimagining of the security posture there. Something certainly should be there, but I'm not exactly sure if the answer to that is razor wire and the deployment that we currently see.
And the former Sergeant Arbs, you don't have any reason, no one's given you any, you've not seen any information that would suggest that we have a threat, an imminent threat that we need the National Guard here?
I have not.
And I have not either. I same resigned on the 7th and have been gone since, so I have no information.
Okay. So who would be making the decision that the National Guard needs to be here then? And where would the threat assessment come from? Does anybody know?
I'd maybe look at the current leadership over at maybe the Capitol Police in conjunction with the current Sergeant Arbs.
Okay, so it would be the head of Capitol Police and the city and the acting Sergeant Arbs.
That is correct. To give you the current information on that.
And would they coordinate with the Metropolitan Police?
Well, if there was intelligence that would indicate the need for such activity, it would usually be shared with our partner, our local law enforcement, would share our perimeter and our borders.
And if there was a threat out there, would that be public? Would there be some public information that they would put out normally?
Again, that all has to do with the nature of the threat, the classification level of the threat. But again, that would be shared with law enforcement within the District of Columbia. Through the joint JTTF as well as the executive board for the JTTF.
I'm flabbergasted that not that you don't know now, but that there's no public information about why we have all these National Guards here.
I'm flabbergasted. I am too, Senator Scott. The chief of the Metropolitan Police Department said, I haven't seen anything to suggest why they're here. I haven't received any intelligence. I have no idea. And by the way, I'm not involved in that decision. And the others were going, the two former sergeant of arms going, I have no idea. I have no information. Oh, man. These are the people that are running important roles in our national government. I'm flabbergasted. 855-295-6600. Short break. We will be right back.
Tom, you're a straight-up guy. I love the show.
He's the smartest guy in the room.
So the question that Rick Scott was asking is a good question. And it's an important question to me. I know people kind of blow it off. Yeah. But so they brought in, you know, and after the National Guard was there that day, finally they got there. And they, you know, repelled everything and pushed the people out of the building. And then the next day they came with those fences. I've seen them around when presidents are traveling. They use those high fences because they're impossible to climb. Whoever came up with them is a genius. Anyway, so they've got those fences, and they've got the concertina wire, and they've got layers, and they've got, you know, levels of if you get past this place, you got to get past another one, and they got the National Guard standing out there, and they're armed. And you go, once they start security someplace, try and take it down. And I am afraid. I think it's bad for our country. I think it's bad for it's a bad sign if they leave our nation's capital guarded like it is, guarded tighter than a prison. That no. You just can't go there. And that's the thing. I saw some of the protesters, the rioters. They were yelling, "This is our house. It's the people's house." Yeah, but. You can't just bust into the federal courthouse and start breaking windows and throwing things around, disrupting the business. So I think it's a weak excuse. But, I mean, on this, I don't know. Why don't we put security around everything? I have to tell you, I'm not sure how this works in other places, but where I live, the building I'm in has lots of security. They have security guards. They got security gates, all that since 9/11. They've got uniformed NYPD. They've got plainclothes NYPD in the building, plus the uniformed security guys and gals, plus the security gates. So that's what we live with in office buildings in New York. I understand why it was originally there. I'm not sure why they still have it. And it's turned out to be a big, big, big business. One of the guys who guards our building with a dog is a retired NYPD guy, a great guy, Frank. And he's we talk every morning. And so he's got this dog, and he's told me over the years about how the dog is trained to sniff for explosives. And so anything and everything, the loading gate where the trucks pull in, before they can unload anything, the dog has to jump in and sniff every package in the truck. Then they can bring the packages in. I mean, it's a high security business. So he was telling me that the guy who started this security business where he works with this dog was a former NYPD police officer and started with him and a dog, and he's just grown it. He's got thousands and thousands of people that work for him and hundreds of dogs, and the guy is very, very wealthy because of it. So good for him. But there's something about our access to the seat of government, and I don't want to – They've already changed it. I have not been to the Capitol since they built the Capitol Center. I told you, I forget what the number was. Whatever it was like 10 times more than what they estimated to build it. But you still have to go through some sort of security before they will let you go into the Capitol building. Used to be you went to the Capitol building, Capitol Police were at every door. They had the, you know, metal detectors, and you went through that, and you went about your business. There's something inherently wrong about having our national seat of government being guarded by soldiers with armed rifles and huge fences and concertina wire. I mean, I don't know if any of you ever been to the Kremlin. You see photos of it, you see videos of it. It's beautiful. You know, that whatever that those spires are that they have there, but I'm sure they have security at the Kremlin, but not like what we have. They don't have Russian soldiers standing out there with big arms, big guns. It's wrong. And so Rick Scott says, why are they still here? Not one of them had an answer. We'll be right back.
Prime time, all the time, with Tom Sullivan.
Prime time it is. I want to move on. We got a lot to cover today. I've got viruses. I've got about the economy. I've got about, the COVID-19 relief bill. Guess what? They changed the name. You know why? Because very, very little of it has anything to do with COVID. So, the new name is the American Relief Act. Sounds like somebody needs to use a restroom or something. I'm not quite sure how to. The American Relief Act. Okay, so speaking of medical things, Fauci is getting it from all sides. He has been giving lots of different messages, and we're getting optimistic because the numbers are coming down. The number of cases are coming way down. The number of positives are down sharply as well for testing. The number of deaths, thank goodness, are falling. I said something yesterday, and I felt bad later because I said, you know, we're 500,000. I know it was a different population. I got a lot of great tweets yesterday about different population in 1918, much smaller. Right? I said there was 625 or some 625,000 died then. And I said, come on, we can do it. And I thought that's really, I thought about that, and I didn't lie. I thought that sounds cold because there's 500,000 people that have died, and they're just a number now. They should not be. They're real people with people that love them and families, and friends and families, and I don't know. This week, I guess I'm more sensitive to people's deaths. You have to be careful. You can't take it in too deep, or it'll drive you zonky. I mean, you'll go crazy. You have to realize death is part of life. But at the same time, what a year for these 500,000 people and their families. And I'm going to guess family of four times four, five, six. I don't know. We'll take your pick. So we're up to a couple million people that are grieving because of what happened in this last year. And I will tell you, I know a lot of you are, I don't like Joe Biden's politics at all. I don't. I disagree. I think he's making huge mistakes. But I thought it was the right thing to do last night when President Biden and his wife and Kamala and her husband, they had 500 candles on the steps of the Capitol, or I'm sorry, the White House, and they came out and had a moment of silence. This is a little bit of what he talked about before he went out to have the moment of silence. This is in the White House last night, 30.
The day will come when the memory of the loved one you lost will bring a smile to your lips before a tear to your eye. We will get through this, I promise you. But my heart aches for you, those of you who are going through it right now.
Yeah, it came across very genuine because of the fact of his history and having to bury his first wife and his little girl, and then burying his son here a couple of years ago. Brett Hume was asked about the president doing that last night.
Part of the portfolio of every president is at times to be the nation's chaplain. Bill Clinton was very good at that. Everybody believed that he felt their pain. It was great politics, and he expressed it, that kind of sentiment, well. It seems to me that Donald Trump took a few cracks at it in his time, but he never really did it very well, and I think it was harmful to him politically. Joe Biden there with an effort reflecting his ability to do that, and as you note, he speaks with some experience. I might add here, though, I mean, this things like this at times like this are pure political gold if you can pull it off. I think most people watching that would think he probably did.
Yeah, I thought he did, but you go, okay, is it necessary? And he you know, for all of you that get mad whenever anybody says something about Donald Trump, I think he was a supporter of President Trump, but Trump wasn't, his skills were in many different buckets, but not the empathy bucket. So that's what he was talking about, I think, more than anything else. I don't know what, if that helps. I don't know the people that lost their loved ones this past year. I don't know if that helps coming out, but I guess that somebody likes it when the president of the United States stops and recognizes the fact that 500,000 people have lost their lives in the last year. And Mo Ellerthy, big spokesman for the Democrats, he said, it's a hard day for all of us, but President Biden is specially qualified to speak about personal loss.
I didn't realize how much I needed to hear that speech until I heard it. This is a hard day. This is a hard day for all of us. 500,000 people That's nearly the population of Atlanta, as if an entire city has disappeared over the past year. And to hear a man who, as you and Britt just referenced, had to bury a wife, had to bury an infant daughter, had to bury an adult son, who's known so much tragedy, speak to all of those around the country who have now experienced that same tragedy of losing a loved one in very personal ways, but by extension, speaking to all of us who have all struggled in this past year, consoling us, grieving with us, as well as reminding us that better days are ahead and urging us to remain vigilant in the efforts to get there. This was a very powerful moment, and one that that really spoke to me on a personal level.
Yeah, I was struck by it. It wasn't something I was expecting. I was kind of surprised by it. And yeah, he has had his loss, but I mean, he described it for those of you that have lost loved ones, talking about the things that I wonder. I know he has speechwriters, but I mean, talking about, you look over at that empty chair at the family dinner table. I mean, just little things like that, and you go, yeah, and you remember. I don't understand. He talks about you've got to be able to remember in order to heal. I don't know. It's so hard when you lose somebody that you love. And I just lost a friend. A lot of you lost a friend. So it was touching last night. They struck up the band, Amazing Grace. Fire it up there, Alex. Would you? They brought out the Marine Band, and you know, Amazing Grace was played, and the president and his wife, and the vice president and her husband, and the lights on the stairs, and it was a touching moment. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm still very sensitive to losing a friend. But you think constantly about your memories with them and how you can't pick up the phone or you can't send them an email anymore. So I don't know if we needed it or not. I hope we're getting to the point where very, very few pass away from this virus. By the way, I've got my second shot scheduled. So I'm getting there. I've got to wait 3 weeks, but I'm getting there. They say the second shot is the doozy. I don't know. First one, I had literally no reaction whatsoever. Anyway, it was different, and I wasn't sure whether I was even going to talk about it because some of you are so political you can't stand anything Joe Biden does. But I thought last night was... it was touching. It touched me. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Unlike most talk hosts, he actually takes your calls live. You're with Tom Sullivan.
I was going to tell you about Fauci and the fact that... he's been criticized all the way along, but they played a montage of basically his mixed messages. This goes back to last March, some of the things that he has said over the last year.
Right now, at this moment, there is no need to change anything that you're doing on a day-by-day basis. But as soon as it became clear that there was community spread, then it became clear that we were in real trouble.
When was that? When was that?
Well, that was probably towards the middle to end of January. Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks. Putting a mask on yourself is more to prevent you from infecting someone else. And if everybody does that, we're each protecting each other.
If one mask is good, two masks are better.
So I'm waiting for the, why don't we wear three? Let's just, three's a charm, right? Something like that. So Dr. Marty McCarry from Johns Hopkins, he says he likes Dr. Fauci, but he's a master of not answering questions.
Well, look, I think Dr. Fauci's done a great job serving this country through AIDS and Ebola and Zika and SARS, but he just missed this one. That's all there is to it. As early as March, or the beginning of March, he had said his strong recommendation was that older Americans should avoid cruises. That's all we heard. And, of course, then all of a sudden was the scramble. So, look, I like Dr. Fauci, but he's a master of not answering questions, like his answer on schools, on his answer on masks, when things are going to be over. He said, quote unquote, we may see something that might resemble a variation of normal. I'm not sure how to interpret that. So he's very good not answering questions.
Yeah, what's a variation of normal? That's my daily routine. I'm never normal. Okay, I understand. So then the question comes out. Now he's saying, well, so you get your shots, you're vaccinated, you're not good to go. You may need to wear masks and do social distancing until 2022. And as far as seeing the grandkids, because he's 80 years old, so that's where he sees things from. I don't know if we're ready to do all of that. So Dr. McCarry says, no, we need to get back, and we need to encourage people to live their lives once they are vaccinated.
I'm a physician, and I can tell you about the power of human touch. When people are anxious, when people are lonely, when people are scared in the hospital, when people are sick, that human touch is better than any medicine. It's powerful, and we've got to rebuild communities. Loneliness is one of the great epidemics that predated COVID, and it's getting worse. It's been magnified. It kills people. It affects your physiologic reserves. So I'm telling people to live their life once they've got a vaccine. Well,
yeah. I like Dr. McCarry. He's saying we'll have herd immunity by April. And he says, no. Once you have your, two-shot regimen, I don't know. When are they going to approve Johnson & Johnson? What are they doing? I think the meeting is coming up this Friday and Saturday, I think. I saw for Johnson & Johnson for the FDA. So they may be approved next week. They're the single dose one, but if you whatever one you get, whatever dose they recommend, Moderna 2, Pfizer 2, J&J 1. But once you've got that, then they say give it 2 weeks for your cells to basically get the information so that it will recognize this bad guy if it gets in you. And then you're good to go. And I have to tell you, I've only got one of my two shots, although I saw where after one shot, I am like 80% protected. Two will get me to 95%. I'm not passing up the second one. I want to get to 100% if I could. So, but with just one shot under my belt, I'm still... You know, if we go down to the store or something like that, I'll wear a mask. But I feel, I don't know what it is. I'm not elated. I'm not jumping for joy. There's just something comforting to know that I am not worried as much about getting the virus. So back to Dr. McCarry, he says, he's going after Dr. Fauci. He says, Fauci simply missed it, and because of that, we paid a heavy price.
I love Dr. Fauci, but he puts his pants on one leg at a time like the rest of us, and he missed it when many of us were out there in February and in early March begging and sounding the alarm and writing letters and begging the NCAA to postpone and South by Southwest to cancel repeatedly, even as I called the White House. Repeatedly, I was told, but Dr. Fauci says he thinks we're going to be okay. And that was a big mistake. We got behind the eight ball and, of course, got behind on a global supply chain. You can only pull so hard on that, and behind on the testing and behind on other things. We paid a heavy price because of it.
I wonder if Dr. Fauci, he seems to be cogent, but he just turned 80. Maybe he's losing a step. Or maybe he's just been in government his whole life and he doesn't, I'm not sure. Skip down to cut 20. Dr. Jha says he thinks, and Dr. Jha has been very, he hasn't been one of these guys that is loosey-goosey. He's pretty tight, uptight about all this. He said by late spring, a vast majority will be vaccinated and we may see some normalcy.
It's not going to be totally back to 2019. I don't know about like large concerts, a bunch of large indoor gatherings. They still feel pretty risky to me. But by the time we get into late spring, I think by May, anybody who wants a vaccine can get one. And by the time we're into July, I think a vast majority of Americans will have been vaccinated. And at that point, I think case numbers will be low. The weather will be warm. So maybe not 100% back to 2019, but pretty close and certainly much closer than what this past summer was like.
I don't know how people are going to feel. I don't know how you're going to feel when you are vaccinated. But with just one shot in me, I'm telling you, I feel, I've never been afraid. I don't know how to express it. That's my job. More confident. Go back. I think people, this, and I want to get into this about the economy. That's the big, big, big discussion on Wall Street is what are people going to do? And I think that there is a huge pent-up demand. It's almost like after, well, a totally different analogy, but after World War II, the economy was a war economy. Everything was thrown at the war. Everything. You couldn't buy anything without being rationed. Car tires, gasoline, all that stuff. So comes 1950, and the people, the coming back from World War II, the young guys and gals, had the baby boomers, they had babies, they bought homes, they bought cars. There was an explosion because of pent-up demand. I think there's a huge pent-up demand right now.